Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. One thing everyone is trying to get a grip on is how the federal sequester will impact Wyoming. Ann Alexander is an economist at the University of Wyoming. She joins me in the studio to discuss this. Ann, as we look at sequester in Wyoming, do we have definitive answers yet?
No, we really don't. There were some estimates that were put out by the White House, by the Office of Management and Budget, of some potential impacts that could be felt in all of the 50 states and that were specific to Wyoming and every other state. But there's still a lot of guesswork involved. And a lot of the reason for that is because, unlike the fiscal cliff where all of the tax rates were going to change the very next day, this is a matter of an $85 billion cut that has people involved with it. So you have to give notices to contractors, you have to give notices to civil service folks. And so a lot of the actual dollar amounts and the effects won't be felt, you know, until starting at the very least until the end of the month. Another kind of piece of uncertainty about it is that the fiscal year's already started. You know, the fiscal year started in October. So they're having to smash all of these cuts into a much shorter period of time. Whereas if sequester continues into another fiscal year, they'll have a full year to sort of, you know, hash out where to put things. So there's still so much uncertainty.
The part of our economy that seems to be out there that strikes me as very interesting is the oil and gas industry and the energy industry. And would you explain how that might be impacted?
Well, because there's a lot of permitting that has to go on, environmental impacts and other kinds of pieces of permitting for drilling, for exploration, and even for production, you're going to see a reduction in the ability of BLM, EPA, all of the other agencies that are involved in this to be able to get out to do inspections, to do permitting. And so both exploration and production could fall or at least see increased wait times to begin processes or to pull things out of the ground.
And maybe one last thing for you. I mean, one of the things you keep hearing from our congressional delegation is this is actually finally going to force cuts that should have happened a long time ago. Senator Enzi thinks that the country should do it a lot like Wyoming did, where you get the agencies to propose different types of cuts. As you look at this, are they right that they probably needed to do something to force their hand and make cuts?
You know, it's interesting. I hear that a lot, and that certainly is it's an understandable point of view. One thing, though, that I did see that's come out from the Congressional Budget Office is that the original caps that were put onto discretionary spending, even before the fiscal cliff and sequestration, that were part of the original Budget Control Act, where all of this came from in 2011, those original caps were actually going to start ramping down defense spending and discretionary spending anyway. So there are some cuts already baked in, regardless of sequestration, into discretionary spending. But to me, and I think to a lot of folks, probably including our congressional delegation, the concern about budgets and long-term deficits and debt has less to do with discretionary spending and a lot more to do with what's called mandatory spending. And you can kind of think of the difference between them as discretionary is short-term spending, mandatory is long-term. Mandatory is spending that you don't have to go back and get budget authority to spend every year. That's Social Security, that's Medicare, and that's Medicaid, and interest on the national debt. And if you look at the long-term predictions that are out there, mandatory spending as a percentage of total spending right now is 64% of total spending. By 2023, it's going to be 76% of total spending. And so those programs are going to continue to grow in their outlays. But revenues aren't going to keep up with expenditures, with outlays. So what really needs fixed? Discretionary spending is large, that's for sure. And so it's understandable for people to say, well, we told them to cut it already. Let's cut it some more. This is the only way we can force spending cuts because the deficit and the debt are getting too large and unsustainable. But the unsustainable parts of the deficits and of the debt in the long run is going to come from the things that they're not touching right now. No one is talking seriously across the aisle with each other in any sort of forum where they would actually do something about reforming the mandatory programs. So we're going to have to borrow, in other words, to continue to fund mandatory spending.
And Alexander is an economist here at the University of Wyoming. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Bob.
In the wake of the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting, there's been an increase in calls for gun control in Washington. Matt Laszlo reports that the Wyoming congressional delegation fears the entire debate is leaving out Western issues.
There might not be a more sensitive issue in politics than guns and the Second Amendment. That may be why the assault weapons ban lapsed in 2004 and then hasn't really been debated in Congress since. But the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut changed things. Now President Obama is calling for sweeping gun control measures, which Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso says goes too far.
There's a strong belief and commitment to our Second Amendment rights, and we know that involves our individual's right to own and bear arms. So the president's promoting positions that go way beyond that of most Americans.
A part of the president's proposal is to reinstate the assault weapons ban and to limit the number of rounds one can keep in a clip. Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says that could have a deadly impact in Wyoming.
Sacrificing a tool that can be used for personal safety in a state where the bear population and the wolf population have grown dramatically would be my paramount reason for opposing an assault weapons ban or the ability to pull the trigger repeatedly in one's own self-defense.
Wyoming senior Republican Senator Mike Enzi brushes aside the gun control proposals floating around Washington.
Hopefully they'll have something that will take care of violence because it's violence that's the problem. We're not solving violence.
Enzi says gun laws should be left up to states.
If the East Coast wants to do it, let them do it. New York just passed some really crazy gun laws that are going to keep every citizen that wants any personal protection from having any.
Wyoming state legislature debated a number of pro-gun bills during its session, and Governor Matt Mead calls Wyoming a gun-friendly state. But Enzi says guns are misunderstood by many in Washington.
Well, the whole anticipation out here on the East Coast is that the only thing you use guns for is to kill people. They don't take into consideration hunting or just target shooting.
Virginia Democratic Congressman Jim Moran supports the president's gun control proposal, but he has also introduced legislation of his own, called the NRA Members Gun Safety Act. It includes provisions like universal background checks and banning anyone on the terrorist watch list from buying a gun. Polls have shown that a majority of gun owners support these provisions.
We ought to have minimal standards for concealed weapon permits, such as being an adult. We ought to require that your gun be reported within 48 hours if it's lost or stolen, things like that. More than two-thirds of NRA members support, so we could at least get that through, particularly the background checks.
But before debate even got rolling on the gun issue, President Obama decided to sign 23 executive orders. Some deal with mental health issues, while others attempt to improve reporting data from states and place it into a federal database. Many Republicans, like Congresswoman Lummis, aren't happy with the president's action.
I expect lawsuits. I expect to be on the side of those who question his authority as an executive without legislation.
There does seem to be bipartisan support for taking further steps to address mental health issues, which gun advocates say is the only common threat in recent mass shootings. Lummis says she may be able to support legislation focused on that limited issue.
I believe that we should be looking specifically at the issues involving the developmentally disabled and mentally ill in a more serious manner.
But Lummis says Congress needs more information before it acts.
We need to understand where the states are with regard to their work on those issues.
And Senator Enzi cautions that even on mental health issues, Congress needs to tread lightly.
We should not put the stigma of violence on everybody that has any kind of a mental health problem.
While this Congress is spending more energy on gun issues than any in the recent past, It's still unclear if lawmakers will find enough points of agreement to pass any gun legislation this session. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we'll take a look back at this year's legislative session. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. It's been over a week since the Wyoming legislature wrapped up the 2013 session. It was a session that many lawmakers called unusual, mainly due to the unexpected legislation that removed powers from State Superintendent of Public Instruction Cindy Hill. The other surprise was that the interaction between legislators and the public got heated at times, especially during debate on gun bills. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck spoke with a number of legislators about the session and has this report.
It's been a very different session, I think. That whole Senate File 104, the Cindy Hill Department of Education bill, that was a different way to start.
That is State Senator Cale Case of Lander, who served in the legislature for over 20 years. He takes issue with the way the legislature solved its dispute with Superintendent Hill. Lawmakers stripped her powers and put someone else in charge of the Department of Education.
I think we went about the superintendent thing the wrong way. I think that would have been better following the process of impeachment if that were warranted. And that whole issue doesn't solve the turmoil in the department, and which still remains, and I think I am disappointed about that.
Gillette Representative Greg Blickrey voted for the change because he thought the legislature's education policies needed to be followed through with.
I can't say I'm happy about it, and in fact, I would have loved it if we hadn't had to deal with that. I'm sure most of us would say that. But in the long term, I mean, those changes were made in the auditor's office some years ago, and it seems to have worked to produce a good result.
Senate Majority Floor Leader Phil Nicholas also says it was a difficult decision, but the right one. But he notes that normally lawmakers ease into a session, and this year was different.
The tension during the starting and the beginning of the session to the middle was about as high as I can remember.
Nicholas says interaction with the public over social issues added to that tension. He blames that on the fact that better organized lobbying groups have been formed to focus on a single issue.
I've always said that if you're only focused on one issue, whether it be guns or Bibles in the classroom or other types of single issues, it allows you to have a view that's fairly narrow.
But Nicholas says those lobbying groups were good at rounding up their supporters and getting them to contact lawmakers in greater numbers. Lawmakers say that some of that interaction featured both threatening and sometimes racist comments. Senator Case says it's an unfortunate part of the process.
Sometimes I think people just make a kind of a profession of nasty notes and hit send. Sometimes folks want to engage in a thoughtful dialogue, and sometimes they just want to tell you off. And certainly around, I think, the Second Amendment and some of the other stuff, it got kind of nasty, and that was too bad.
Representative Blickrey says when they debate gun issues or topics like domestic partnerships, it can get tense on and off the floor.
Emotion takes over in a lot of cases, so it does get chaotic.
Are they necessary, though? Do we need to have these discussions?
Yeah, I think so.
Representative Stan Blake, a Democrat, left the session disappointed about a few issues.
I was opposed to the fuel tax because we are banking money, and I was opposed to that. Another thing was Medicaid expansion. We are leaving 17,000 people without insurance, and we could have very simply have done that this session instead of having studies and see what happens next year.
Ethity Democrat Patrick Goggle says his biggest disappointment was in not approving the Medicaid expansion, but he also thought that the state could have used money it put into savings to pay for a range of needs.
I do think that we're stockpiling our investments into savings, and we probably could have used some of that to fund some of the projects we did this year.
Lawmakers say they don't have the PR machine that some of the lobbying organizations have, and so they're spending the next few weeks explaining their actions to people back home. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
A report released by a coalition including the Wyoming Business Council, the University of Wyoming, and the Idaho National Laboratory detailed why Wyoming should diversify its energy production methods and how the state could use its abundant natural resources in value-added projects. That's when raw resources are processed into more complex fuels and energy instead of just being burned. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff spoke with CEO of the Wyoming Business Council, Bob Jensen, and manager at the Idaho National Lab, Richard Boardman, about why value-added projects are important and what Wyoming can do to get on board.
Wyoming has, for decades, provided a lot of the raw material for energy consumption to the rest of the nation, and it's helped our economy and it's helped the nation. But as we look at ways that in Wyoming we can try to diversify our economy and ways that we can continue to have all of those energy resources that we have in abundance here be more relevant and have higher values to the state and to the nation, I think that is the reason why we're interested in trying to figure out a way how to add value to those resources so that they remain relevant and useful and cost-effective and environmentally sound to the state and to the nation.
Current efforts to establish, just to focus on carbon conversion for a second, have had trouble funding it. I'm talking about DKRW coal-to-liquids plant here. Is startup capital and lackluster investors something that was considered as an impediment in your research? And were there other challenges that applied to wind or uranium or other carbon conversion projects?
You ask an important question, and sometimes we look at the market that exists today, which is driven by people who own resources and make investments in maximizing their profits on the resources they sell, somebody who builds an industry and they generate one product. And so they don't often look at a more inclusive market. We're now speaking about sharing energy among various users and creating a new market. And so there are certainly some challenges in order to build hybrid energy systems that will require that there be partnerships and cooperation among the energy users and energy product producers. So part of this has to be, the education, which is bringing the resource holders and the folks who will build the plants or the companies that will build these plants together to help them understand how they, in fact, can increase their revenue when working together. And the study goes into those aspects. In the case of DKRW, of course, they're doing this in the most challenging of times, what folks are now classifying as the Great Recession. And so there's been difficulties, potentially in being able to find the types of investments to make on something that which is relatively new and therefore may be perceived as having certain risks that are challenging for institutions and financial people to make those investments. Now, as we pull out of an economy, I think that we're starting to see a sense, both on the large energy industries and as well as the investment community, that the risks are starting to hopefully look acceptable, that they can move forward with a project such as the DKRW project.
So how much is this report a call to action aimed at existing industry? How much is it to new industry? And how much does any of this going forward depend on policy on a state and national level?
It clearly helps existing industry understand a way forward, be able to understand what their value-added opportunities could be. New industries, new technologies also have a role to play here. And in terms of what are our next steps forward from this, I think that's probably one of them, is the technologies and the resource owners, including the state and the federal government, really need to understand what kinds of things need to happen for industry to move forward with these opportunities. Some of those involve policy decisions, permitting questions, incentive questions, those kinds of things. But I think that at the end of the day, the state government for Wyoming is clearly very interested. Both the governor and the legislature have indicated by their actions that they are very interested in these opportunities and want to look at appropriate ways for our state government to be able to help industry move forward. And then it's a question about where the federal government stands and if there is a role and how big that role is going forward. But clearly, it's industry that's going to drive this going forward into the near and long-term future.
Mm-hmm. And just to take kind of a more solid example, you know, if Wyoming coal companies right now are focused on sending coal abroad to deal with a weakening U.S. market for their product, will value-added projects like those proposed in your report be enough motivation in terms of value to them to keep the coal here and do something else with it?
Well, I think that this is a piece of a broader set of solutions for keeping our carbon resources relevant to the nation and to the world, really. So while carbon conversion projects will be part of the answer for both coal and for natural gas, I think that export markets are also an answer, part of the solution for those industries going forward.
Well, it sounds like this diversification would be just as important for the state's own survival and progress as it would be kind of on a national and perhaps even global level.
These resources that we have in this country, and particularly in Wyoming, carbon-based resources, renewable resources such as wind, and nuclear resources such as uranium, all can work together to help us understand how we can move forward with an energy supply that continues to drive our economy at affordable prices for our people, and do it in a way that is environmentally acceptable. So this is a pathway, not just for Wyoming, really, but it's a pathway for the nation and for the globe. This is a way to get the benefit of the energy resources that have grown our economy in a way that recognizes that there are ways to do it and reduce those greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm. To wrap up, can you both tell me what the solid next steps need to be in order to go forward? And I guess this would be both on the part of industry as well as the state.
The near term would be, utilizing the coal, the oil, the natural gas, the wind resources that we already have in value-added ways, such as gas to liquids operations, coal to gas to liquids operations. Those kinds of technologies are already out there. There's a number of companies in the state. Midterm, incorporating wind into those kinds of operations is certainly doable. And looking at the uranium fuel cycle, we already mine the bulk of the uranium that's used in this country domestically here in Wyoming. There's no reason why, as that continues to expand, we can't go the next step up the fuel cycle and convert that uranium into the next phase of its conversion process to nuclear fuel. And then long-term, when it comes to small modular nuclear high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, all of the new technologies for the use of uranium and small modular nuclear components in these hybrid energy systems plants, it makes a lot of sense for us to do that.
At this point, we need to go forward in understanding where there are technology development needs and demonstration needs, and to put together plans to help us arrive at these commercial plants. And that means we need to involve industry and develop partnerships that work in concert with the Wyoming School of Energy Resources at the University of Wyoming. National labs will have a role, and again, private industry need to be part of those partnerships. And then from the state's perspective, they can begin to realize and understand what policies or strategies they want to establish that help to move towards these projects, so ultimately resulting in projects in the state, which is a great place to start and to have some of these first plants built and demonstrated for the nation, and as I said earlier, potentially for the international community as well.
All right, Bob Jensen, Richard Boardman, thank you so much for making time to talk.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Irina.
When we come back, we'll talk with UW's incoming president, and we'll visit a ski area that's hoping to reopen in the Bighorns. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Antelope Butte ski area in the Bighorn Mountains has been closed since 2004. Now, the Antelope Butte Foundation is raising money to reopen the ski resort, this time as a nonprofit. The foundation has applied for a Wyoming Business Council grant to refurbish the resort, but the owner of the nearby Meadowlark Ski Lodge is worried that the competition could kill his business. Wyoming Public Radio's Luke Hammonds reports.
Off of US 14, about an hour west of Sheridan, snow falls on the still chairlifts of the now-defunct Antelope Butte ski area. Weak snowfall and financial troubles caused the business to fold nearly a decade ago, and the property went to the US Forest Service, which owns the mountain. When the Forest Service failed to sell the ski area, a group of local ski enthusiasts formed a nonprofit, hoping to reopen it. Matt Weitz of the Antelope Butte Foundation took me up to the resort. Those are my snowshoes.
Our mission is to reopen this, but our real focus is on making mountain recreation and skiing accessible and affordable to beginners and youth.
It's been a while since kids in the area have been able to ski close to home. The nearest ski area to Sheridan is at least an hour and a half away. White says it will cost about $3 million to get Antelope Butte up and running again. They'll have to refurbish the lodge and chairlifts, as well as buy groomers, snowplows, and other equipment. They have help, though. Bighorn County has joined the fundraising effort. The county has applied for a grant from the Wyoming Business Council to reopen the Antelope Butte ski area. Business Council spokeswoman Molly Spangler says having a ski mountain would benefit local businesses by making the area more attractive to outsiders.
It would be bringing back an asset to the area that has been underutilized for the past few years, and it would allow a space for people to come and recreate and gather, you know, not just through Bighorn County, but in Washakie and Johnson and Sheridan County and throughout the state.
Skiers think having another ski area will be good, too. On a bright Saturday after a fresh snowfall, there's a healthy turnout on the slopes of Meadowlark Ski Resort, the other ski area in the Bighorn Mountains. Many of the skiers drove all the way from Sheridan to get here. Sean Blanche is one of them.
My name is Sean Blanche, and I'm from Sheridan, Wyoming. I think I would join both places, and I would go to both of them. It's important to support your local ski lodge, and I love them. So, love to go to both, I think.
But skiers splitting their time between two resorts is the last thing the owner of Meadowlark, Wayne Jones, wants.
If Antelope Butte opens up, I just don't see how we have a chance in hell of surviving. I mean, how am I supposed to compete with a nonprofit? I mean, think about it. A nonprofit, they can sell their ski tickets as cheap as they want, and they can lose as much money as they want. All they got to do when they lose money is just go recruit some more tax-free money. We don't have that option.
Jones is worried that if Antelope Butte Ski Area reopens, both ski areas will go under. It wouldn't be the first time. Meadowlark and Antelope Butte were both closed for a while. Jones bought Meadowlark at auction and reopened a few years ago. He says business is growing, but he thinks North Central Wyoming lacks the population to support two ski areas. But Emerson Scott, who used to run Antelope Butte, says that's not necessarily true.
When both Meadowlark and Antelope Butte were running and running well, they both had their highest skier days then. And it created, in my mind, kind of a critical mass where you had a lot of interest in the area, in the central part of northern Wyoming, and that thus it generated more skier visits. And when one of those mountains would cease to operate, it actually hurt numbers at the other mountain because the overall interest rate died.
Even though Scott thinks North Central Wyoming can support two ski areas, he says it would probably only work if both were nonprofits. That way, they'd only have to break even, not turn a profit, and they could get donations and perhaps state money to stay in business. The Antelope Butte Foundation has raised more than $150,000 from private donors, and they hope to get state grant money within the next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Luke Hammonds.
Dr. Robert Sternberg is the incoming president of the University of Wyoming. Sternberg is a noted psychologist who is currently the provost at Oklahoma State University. In other interviews, Sternberg has made it clear that a key focus of his will be improving academics at UW, and he's also a big supporter of athletics. I asked him to talk about a few other issues.
Well, as a provost at Oklahoma State, it's been pretty public, too. And I see it as a really big plus for the University of Wyoming. I'm sorry. The University of Oklahoma, I was going to say, and Oklahoma State, which are the two major four-year universities in Oklahoma. are in a position where, for better or worse, they're very frequently competing with each other for resources, and it can get kind of hairy, as we might say. So I think that being the one four-year comprehensive university in the state of Wyoming is actually a plus, because then people's loyalties are to the University of Wyoming, and everybody in the state wishes the best for it. In Oklahoma, for example, and in many states, not everyone does actually wish the best for any given university because of the competition.
Have you had much experience in lobbying or working with legislators and that sort of thing? Because that does seem to be part of the president's job here.
Yeah, it's actually an important part of the provost's job, too, in the academic domain. But I know our senator, our state senator, and our state representative, and I have made contacts with many others because we're constantly, I wouldn't use the word lobbying, but educating legislators as to the importance of what we do and how we can serve the state. And I think the best way to educate legislators and the general public of the state is to show them the many ways in which the university serves the state is there economically to benefit the state, and is there as well to really to benefit everyone in the state from its teaching, research, and service. So I view it as an educational process, and as a land-grant institution, the University of Wyoming really is there to serve the state and make everyone's life and state better.
Well, what is that line between, I guess, doing things always for industry and actually doing, I guess, research that maybe could make some people upset?
Well, I think that we want to partner with industry, and we want to partner with nonprofits, and we want to partner with educational organizations and find areas of endeavor that are of mutual benefit to the industries or the nonprofits or the educational groups or whatever, and the university. And I think that many state universities have been successful at doing that, and I think that Wyoming has done a lot of that and that there's always room for improvement. So I really welcome the opportunity to partner with different businesses, different corporations, different nonprofits, different kinds of organizations in the state for the mutual benefit of everybody.
One of the things that is going on in our state, and this is not going to be foreign to you because I think every state has already dealt with this, but when you come in, obviously you're going to have great ideas about how to improve education and improve UW, but you're coming in at a time where the state is looking at some budget cuts. How can you make both work?
Well, I think budget cuts are happening in just about every state. They're certainly happening in the state of Oklahoma. Our budget has just been cut, and I think that's pretty common. And so what you want to do is really, first of all, ask, is everything we're doing really to the maximum benefit of the university and the state? Budget cuts are always hard, but sometimes there's an opportunity in budget cuts in that can ask you, what's the intersection of our strengths, our passions, and the ways in which we can serve the state? And are we doing those as much as we can? And are there other things we're doing maybe that it's time just to think about the return on investment and whether they should be maybe merged with something or even discontinued. And sometimes it can be an opportunity actually to strengthen the areas in which you're most interested by making them more efficient and making them operate in a smoother way.
Do you think you'd have an advantage coming in from the outside in leading that kind of effort?
Well, I think the advantage of coming in from the outside, as I found when I came to Oklahoma State, is that you bring in a fresh perspective.
Right.
Sometimes people get used to the way things have been done, and if you've been in a place long enough, it gets a little bit hard sometimes to see they're being done any other way. So I think that that's a way in which I would have an advantage. A disadvantage is that you don't know as well how things are done, and you don't know as well why they've been done over a period of years. So what I found as provost at Oklahoma State is that I acquired advisors and people who worked with me as a team who had much greater experience in the state and who had greater tacit knowledge. And so by combining myself from the outside with advisors and team members from the inside, hopefully we got the best of both worlds.
As you research the University of Wyoming, are you satisfied, or maybe let me ask it this way, are you concerned about the decline in where maybe Wyoming sits as far as the marketplace for salaries?
Wyoming salaries are not as high, I think, as anyone would like them to be. They're below the range that probably I think most people in the state would consider ideal. And, of course, one always hopes for more state support. But I've said publicly that my number one priority when I get to Wyoming is first to form relationships around the state and get to know people and have them get to know me and learn more about what the university can do for the state. And once I've started to form relationships, to raise money. The primary job of a university president these days is philanthropy. And it's not only convincing people to help the university, but really convincing them to help themselves. Because when you give a gift to the university, it's your chance to make a difference to an organization you really believe in and that you know can have a long-term enduring how the university is serving the state and making the state a better place to live. So, yes, I think that will be very important.
Another question. This came from an energy industry person who was curious about your knowledge of the energy industry.
Well, the energy industry is the leading industry in the state of Oklahoma. So although I don't have a degree in engineering or energy-related fields, a lot of my work here has been working with the energy industry. And our vice president for research and I published an article in one of our two major newspapers, Tulsa World, on our views regarding the long-term energy prospects for the state. So it is something that has been very important to me in my job in Oklahoma at the Oklahoma State University, and I think that at least some of that experience will transfer to Wyoming.
Dr. Robert Sternberg, a pleasure. We'll look forward to chatting with you more in the future, and thank you for joining us in Open Spaces.
Yeah, super. Thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you.
When we come back, we'll talk with the producer of a new documentary about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. A documentary about the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad is set to air on Wyoming PBS this weekend. The film will show how the building of the railroad shaped Wyoming into the place it is today. We're joined now by the film's producer, Tom Manning. He says before the railroad was built, there was no Wyoming.
Wyoming was part of Dakota Territory. It wasn't even a state or a territory itself. And when the Union Pacific came through in the fall of 1867, it hit Pine Bluffs, but it worked its way over to Cheyenne. And when it hit Cheyenne, they decided that they were going to make Cheyenne a division point, which meant that Cheyenne was going to be a city with a lot of railroad infrastructure. And when word got out about this, Cheyenne really, really took off. The people of Cheyenne were real boosters, and they very quickly petitioned to have a Wyoming territory. And Dakota Territory was more than happy to get rid of this far-flung suburb of theirs. So in 1868, as the railroad was being built across Wyoming, Wyoming got territorial status. And then, of course, from that point, it was statehood.
How did the railroad shape Wyoming into sort of what it is today?
Right. Well, without the Transcontinental Railroad going across Wyoming, of course, there would be no Wyoming. You know, it was quite a vast emptiness out there. None of the towns were there. There was some fur trappers and mountain men, and there was a little bit of gold exploration going on up at South Pass City. But basically, from present-day Cheyenne to Evanston, there wasn't much. And the fact that the railroad chose this route to go across Wyoming meant that this whole southern tier of the state was going to find population. And the interesting thing about the Transcontinental Railroad in Wyoming was, you know, usually transportation, that kind of infrastructure, comes into play after there has been a population centers, there's been people around. Well, this was one of the few instances where transportation preceded population.
Now, obviously, some of the towns along the railroad, places like Laramie and Rock Springs, still exist, still are very much towns today. Mm-hmm. Other towns don't exist anymore. What did some of these places do right to sort of stay on the map?
Yeah. Well, part of it was the what I talked about before was the division points. If the railroad decided that they were going to make this community into a railroad town, more than likely that town survived. Now, there are other places that were just more or less whistle stops. There was a town called Benton, which is about, 10, 15 miles east of Rawlins. And Benton was a hellhole. Alkali dust was everywhere. Murders and shootings were everyday occurrences. Prostitution was rampant. And when the railroad was building there, all this was occurring. But the moment the railroad left, businesses packed up their tents. The saloon owners had packed up their wares. They packed them on the train and moved to the next end-of-track town, which were also called hell-on-wheels towns.
What was the most interesting or eccentric character that you sort of came across in researching this film?
You know, I do follow the Transcontinental Railroad across the state, and it's kind of this 1868 timeline. But in, you know, various points along the way, I kind of go vertically in time when a story connects with the railroad. And one of those stories I ran across was happened in Rawlins. And it was about this guy named Big Nose George. And he and a group of outlaw friends tried to rob a train. But basically, they were inept and couldn't pull it off. So they retreated to Elk Mountain. And sheriff's deputies tracked them down. And there was a shooting. And all the deputies and the sheriff were killed. Big Nose George escapes, goes up to Montana, starts bragging about it. He's brought back down to Rawlins, held trial. They decide to hang him, but before they can, the citizens revolt and break him out of jail, take him down to the town square and lynch him. And they're as bad at lynching him as how Big Nose was robbing trains. The poor guy's up there. They lynched him, had to lynch him twice. He was clinging on to the pole. Basically, he struggled and struggled, and it actually took his ears off, the rope did, before he finally died. But the interesting part of the story is these two doctors took the body, and one of them wanted to do research on the criminal mind, and so he did brain autopsies and all kinds of strange stuff. The other guy was bored, I guess, and had other motives in mind, and he had the skin removed and tanned and sent to Denver to be tanned and actually had a pair of shoes made out of Big Nose George's skin. And lo and behold, this guy becomes the governor of Wyoming and wears the shoes to his inauguration.
Wow, that's quite a story. Yeah. All right, Tom Manning, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tom Manning is producer of the film End of Track, which premieres on PBS on March 10th at 7 p.m.
The University of Wyoming invites thinkers and doers from all corners of academia to visit and work at the university and add some perspective to the curriculum. The Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program has invited poet and labor activist Mark Nowak to serve as its eminent writer in residence for a few weeks this year. Nowak has sat in on writing classes and read student manuscripts, but during his weeks in Wyoming, he organized four writing workshops in the Cheyenne and Laramie communities, where he and MFA grads encourage workers from various trades to write poetry about their own experiences in the workplace. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez sat in on one workshop in Laramie.
Mark Nowak has invested a lot of time in other people's writing. He directs the graduate creative writing program at Manhattanville College in New York, and his most recent book, Coal Mountain Elementary, gathers testimony of West Virginia miners and rescue workers, excerpts from pro-coal school curriculum, and news clips from mining disasters in China. NOAC has also organized a series of writing workshops for laborers, most notably unionized auto workers in the U.S. and South Africa.
And really what it is trying to create various kinds of public spaces in which the stories of working people's lives can be told, whether they're miners or nurses or clerical workers or bus drivers, whatever they happen to be, because in the contemporary media, we don't often hear many of those stories.
NOAC says he's interested in hearing the stories of Wyoming workers during his few weeks in the state. He says he learns more about people from what they write than from what they say when he simply asks them about their lives, putting them on the spot.
Writing gives you a time to reflect. It gives you a time to erase. It gives you a time to revise and rewrite. That's something that doesn't happen in the interview.
What is the SAM moment?
This particular workshop happens in the evening in a classroom at the Laramie Plains Civic Center. NOAC hangs back, sitting with a handful of participants who've been invited to come write. MFA graduate Estella Soto is leading tonight's workshop. She's asking participants to write about a time they've felt appreciated at work and then about a time they felt unappreciated.
It's been kind of a diverse group of people. In every workshop, we've had about 10 people sit in. We've had some friends from Coca Radio. We had Connie Coca involved, some construction workers from in town, retirees. We have an elementary school teacher, a university professor. Who else?
Tonight, there's an older gentleman in a blazer who works in a store in town. Several of the young people are English or writing students at UW who have jobs outside school. One works at a business that wires money, another at a restaurant. Estella plays a video of a woman named Christine reading a poem she'd written in one of NOAC's past workshops in New York. Christine was from Tobago and had been working as a nanny in Manhattan.
Cotton picking days ain't over. Madam List. Grow, grow, and grow. Lighthouse keeping, walk dog, let baby be first priority.
Christine's poem describes the growing amount of work added to her initial responsibility and the distaste for the foreign city she finds herself in. Her poem is a pantoum, a style that repeats lines within a series of quatrains. Estella Soto has printed out a worksheet for each writer to create his own pantoum with a guide for which lines should be repeated and when. She encourages each poet to choose the strongest images from their initial writings about whether or not they felt appreciated at work. After a time, they took turns reading their work. Rod Miller works in a shop, but grew up ranching. He wrote a poem about coming of age when his father sent him to herd cattle by himself. He was about 10 at the time. Here's a portion.
I'm ready to do a man's work by myself for the first time. Dad says I'm ready. What if I get bucked off? I'm cold and sleepy. By myself for the first time. No help. No help, no help. What if I get bucked off? What if all these cows explode? No help, no help, no help.
School teacher Nicole Kelly loves her current job, but wrote a pantoum about a stressful one she used to have. She says she remembers being asked to take on extra work without much support from other staff and never seeing sunlight before or after her work day.
Paper piles cry my name. Future is in the balance. Blinding computer screen shines through the darkness. Paper piles cry my name. Empty home filled with wrappers from gas station dinners, blinding computer screens shining through the darkness.
Not all the poems were about stress. Some were about repetition, and some were about reflection and love of one's work. UW student Jason Deese wrote a poem about his job in the food service industry. He says he enjoyed hearing everybody's poems.
It's kind of refreshing to hear the people who aren't trying to follow any rules or just trying to say what they need to say and hope you'll listen.
Worker poets from this workshop read their pieces at a poetry reading at Laramie's Griffin Theater the following night. Workshop leader Estella Soto said she was excited to hear everyone invest themselves in their pieces.
A lot of them coming into the workshop thought they didn't have anything to contribute. They were surprised that they were asked to be involved. They felt like they didn't really have anything special to say. And what I want them to take away is for them to realize that they do, giving them the tools to speak about themselves in a way and realize that they do have stories to share.
Soto says she'd like to encourage more non-writers to write and is looking into hosting future writing workshops at a local community center. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
You can hear full recordings of some of the poems from the workshop at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow all of us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.